stories about me. But anyway, I have written a book called Dying to Live, which is about my story about the past, well, nearly 10 years now, of with cancer. So this book has sort of explained some of what I've gone through. And what I'm going to do today is just, I've picked out some chunks from the book just to give you a flavour of the book itself, mainly because I want you to buy one. I can try and big it up as something else, but ultimately, I feel like it's a good read, and I hope it would be inspiring to you. So the chunks aren't necessarily the story in a chronological sense. They really are just taken out of the book to give you an idea of what type of book it is. I hope it doesn't put you off. So, I have a story. This story is the life I've led for the past 9 years with my husband and band of four little merry Simpsons. Well, maybe more of the moody than the merry, but that would have sounded such a downbeat thing to share at this early stage, so we'll stick with merry for now. Many people have encouraged me to tell this story, so you can blame them if it's rubbish. They say they think I'm amazing, and they don't know how I've coped and remained so positive. What's my secret? How do I keep going? Maybe I have no secret. Maybe I am Superwoman. Okay. This next chunk is quite early on in the whole story, and it was about 2 weeks before I discovered that I had breast cancer. I had a surprise, and I discovered that I was unexpectedly pregnant with the fourth child. So I've called this bit surprise, surprise. Mark arrived home. He did not know what I knew. He was blissfully enjoying living in the world of three lovely little girls. He didn't know that number four was about to be revealed. Our youngest two would be only 12 months apart. I felt for him. I really did. I was sitting on the bar stool, pregnancy test kind of hidden in my hand down here somewhere, and Mark walked into the kitchen. The children had run away and were playing somewhere. In the background, the sounds of them laughing was ricocheting around our home. Mark was smiling and bouncy, and reading his body language, it would be fair to deduce that he'd had a good time out with the girls. I felt like a wicked mastermind about to press the button that would blast Mark's happy Sunday into the four dark corners of the universe. There was some very brief, oh, hello, dear. Oh, yeah, hi, you know, followed. I'd never been very good at the whole small talk when hubby gets in scenario. I was far more of a launch straight into offloading the top traumatic tale of my day kind of wife. At that moment, I was sitting on one heck of a traumatic tale. Whopping piece of news. A blue line was about to rock his world. Here I go. Mark, what's the worst thing that could happen to us right now? I had his attention. He looked a bit alarmed, then worried, and then sort of mad. When he spoke, there was an undercurrent of anger in his voice. I was quite taken aback. My mild-mannered husband was displaying negative emotions towards me. I didn't sign up to be spoken to like this. Unsure how to manage this rare attitude, I just stopped speaking and gawped at him. And this is what he said. "You've scratched the car pulling it into the drive again, haven't you?" I laughed out loud. Mark was about to be served a very big lesson on perspective. I was just so relieved that at least 50% of the mess we were in was his fault. So it was about 2 weeks later from discovering I was pregnant that we went away for just a night in a nice hotel in York. Mark's parents came up to look after the children, and we just needed to get away, you know, and kind of process this unexpected news. It didn't quite turn out the way we were imagining it would be. I think I might have lost my page. Sorry. I'll just tell the story. It just might not be quite as flowing. I ran into the hotel room, you know, as any sane mother who's escaped from her raucous rabble of snotty children and left them in somebody else's hands. And I threw myself onto the king-size double bed, sort of spread-eagled like a starfish, making sure there was absolutely no room for Mark. And that's when I found, in this kind of relaxed state of no children jumping on me like I was some sort of bouncy castle, and I found just a pea-sized lump in my left breast. I wasn't that worried about it because I just had a baby and I was pregnant again with another one. So Mark Googled it, and Google said, "Oh, don't worry about it. It's likely to be hormonal." And I was like, "Yeah, we weren't worried about it anyway." So, but good for Google, and they can give you a lot of helpful information. And that's where we left it at. We didn't go on to sort of work out what else it might be. Made an appointment with the doctor for the next night just to have all this checked out, and then off we went for our night in York. Night on the town, no children, blissful. Probably less heels and happy hour and more joggers and juice bars, but nevertheless, we had our time out. After I'd been to the doctor and had some tests, I received a phone call that is forever ingrained in my memory and my experience. "Mrs. Simpson, the results of the biopsy that I took this morning have come back from the lab, and I'm afraid it confirms that there are breast cancer cells present." My immediate thought was, "But I'm having a baby. What about my baby?" It is so hard to write about that moment and do it justice. I don't think it is a moment that can be described. It's just catastrophic. My memory doesn't recall anything being very sequential. I didn't go through a series of responses. I remember it more like a rushing, tumbling, cascading sensation of many, many thoughts and feelings under which I was simply drowning. I felt darkness close around me, rather as if someone had engulfed me and my happy enough life in a heavy black shroud and then repeatedly spun me around. I was completely disorientated. The seconds it took to be told I had cancer, I changed. Everything changed. I knew life was never going to be the same again, and I can't describe how devastating that is. I'd begun a journey with grief that simply broke my heart. I had no idea at that moment just how painful it was all going to be and how many losses, but I knew deep down that nothing would ever be the same again. And it hasn't been. Something I learned early on in this journey is that even something as tragic as cancer can be used as a benefit. So I have called this section the cancer card. Don't judge me. You don't know what you'd do if you were in my situation. So I'm going to share it with you, because I know you're all lovely people and you'll fully understand. I realised as the years rolled by that the cancer card could come in very handy. If Mark said no to something that I really wanted, I would pull out the cancer card. Just remember, Mark, I have cancer. It preceded many requests, apart from things like clothes and shoes. It's been useful for larger items too, such as holidays or weekends away. I know for certain it was cancer that eventually persuaded him to agree to our hideous green sofa being replaced. We'd bought it in haste in a very reputable furniture shop, but I don't know what I was thinking of. From the moment it arrived, I hated it, but I couldn't tell Mark. It was so green. It was lime green, lurid, lucid lime green. Green was not one of my colours for home furnishing. I have never decorated anything in green, and I have never, ever gone in for bold colours in furnishings, especially not grass-coloured green sofas. But Mark loved it. He wailed and gnashed his teeth when I eventually made a full and honest confession to my distaste for it. He promptly told me that we'd have to have it for at least 20 years, given the cost and the quality of it. Believe me, he told me that I had to just accessorise it, but there is nothing that can accessorise a lime green sofa and make it look nice. The only thing I found to work was brown and cream, but it kind of turned the room into some sort of 70s throwback, and not in a funky way. The green sort of glowed when the sun hit it and cast a sickly green hue onto the cream walls everywhere, and it totally depressed me. Cancer rescued me from my 20-year prison sentence, swathed in tones of green. Mark, I might get too sick to get up the stairs. Please don't let me die on this horrendous green sofa. That was the deal breaker. My lovely, loving, lush fella agreed to the green sofa being banished. I now have a calm haven in shades of grey that when I take my last breath, I'll be more than happy to recline on it. After we knew all the facts and all the details about my condition and what was going to happen to me, and I was going to need a mastectomy and the baby was going to be fine, and you know, all that had been cleared up, one thing became very clear, because I was going to be having chemotherapy and then radiotherapy. So we knew that we needed to get some help with the children. And because of the amount, the intensity it was going to be, the conclusion that we came to is that it had to be somebody full-time and somebody who could work in and out when we needed, as much as we needed. So we embarked upon the journey of trying to find ourselves a nanny. The nanny search We started the process immediately. Interviewing nannies was certainly not a position either of us ever expected to find ourselves in. Attila the Hun, well, she was out straight away. I was sure she'd keep them in line. Her facial hair alone would be enough to silence them. They'd be able to twirl it round their plump little fingers and giggle at its wiry feel. But even my knees were knocking underneath the table from her terrifying stare. So she wasn't the one for us. Mary Poppins, she came along and she was very sweet, but sort of a bit sickly. A spoonful of sugar, one too many for my liking. Now the big mama. Wow, she was awesome. She promised us homemade pasta, meltingly good pizza and gelato. And I could feel my thighs getting larger with each calorific laden description. I imagined me and the mama swigging glasses of red wine around the kitchen over the large pan of bubbling bolognese, singing, "That's amore." I couldn't take my eyes off her enormous bazookas. I don't know so much about the moon hitting my eye like a big pizza pie. It was more likely to be her very large swinging breasts. But the idea of Friday evenings slurring after too much wine was certainly amore to me. But it would be a situation that I knew would end in tears. The result of all those booze-riddled evenings would be me eventually looking like an oversized piece of pale, dumpy gnocchi. For health reasons alone, she didn't get a second interview. It was a big process, this. Then there was the pretty princess. Oh, I mean, absolutely beautiful, blonde, petite girl, perfect skin, perfect body. But there was no way I was going to be accompanied anywhere with her. It would be like Mr. Blobby hanging out with Taylor Swift. And as my pregnant body would enlarge and balloon over the coming 7 months, this tiny, minuscule little doll dressed in skin-tight jeggings and itsy-bitsy, teeny-weeny tops that looked like she'd borrowed them off a Barbie doll would be lost forever in the yards of fabric for my voluminous, tent-like mothercare maxi maternity dresses. I mean, who would do that to themselves? And if I really lost it, which I was more than capable of with all the hormones and the chemotherapy, well, I might simply launch myself at her, rather like a large hippopotamus might, and flatten her underneath my huge stomach. In the interests of saving her life, she would not be employed. We did find our girl. She'd been a nursery nurse for many years, and she adores our children. She was also pretty, tall and blonde, but she had an eye that looked the wrong way, and somehow this made her more human. And she's still with us to this day on a Saturday. Amazing girl, Hannah. Hannah, yeah! Hannah! She knew who I was talking about, didn't she? Okay. Up until the point when I had the mastectomy, I wasn't somebody who ever sort of experienced ill health of any type whatsoever, and I certainly had never been into hospital. I knew I had it all laid out for me, what was going to happen. You know, I knew exactly what to expect, and you know, I knew the baby was going to be okay, and we were going to have growth scans every sort of week for that. And so I was very clear in my mind, as far as I could be, what this experience in hospital was going to be like. The thing that perhaps wasn't so explained, because I expect it's just normal in everyday life for nurses and doctors and people who are relaying information to patients, was the sort of more like the pre-op stuff. So this is just a little insight into my first experience into hospital, getting ready for an operation. Compression stockings. getting the darn things on is nothing short of hilarious. I was given some super small stockings. I like to think this was because, despite my being at that point in pregnancy where you might be pregnant, but you might just have eaten too many pie stage, they had viewed me as a reasonably small lady, so hence I got small stockings. But they were so small that I couldn't imagine them even stretching over a small dog's leg, never mind my 5'4½ woman's leg. But I was told it had to be done. It was exhausting. I sat on the side of the bed while Mark rolled them up, rather like putting socks on a kid. He fed the white stretchy tunnel over my foot, and then I heaved and wriggled and jumped up and down and pulled the things up and over my knees, which was like squeezing a football into the arm of a jumper. I writhed and jumped up and down and heaved and pulled these necessities onto both my legs. It remained to be seen, once they were there, whether I would actually just burst out of them like a sausage from its cooked skin. I did make Mark laugh, though, as I strutted around my hospital room in my strange garb like an escaped mental patient, my flapping gown open at the back with my big maternity knickers on display and my thick white stockings that pushed every ounce of fat and tissue onwards and upwards from my calves and thighs to spill over the top in my crotch area. I've never worn tummy and thigh control underwear. And after this experience, I didn't intend to try. I get the concept, but I fail to see how such items really do hide that fat. It has to go somewhere. My logical brain said, well, it will spill out when it gets the chance to be released. And these compression stockings proved my theory. A small tire of fat now circulated my leg at the top of the stocking. I had to lie down while Mark fanned me on the bed. It was a great relief when the door opened. My trolley awaited me, and I embarked on the ride of my life. Oh, those things, honestly. Anyway, now you know. If you're ever going to go in for an operation, if you've never been in before, then you might have to get into the stockings. Secondaries. Being diagnosed with primary breast cancer is, you know, earth-breaking. It does. You can't believe it. But, you know, breast cancer is a very treatable and curable cancer to have. I think the statistic is something like 90 to 95% of people never experience any recurrences from it. And that's what I'd been told that, so that's what I believed. But in 2012, I was told that my cancer had come back. And I already knew enough about having secondary breast cancer that made it a world apart from primary cancer. You didn't get cured. They could give you treatment that could help and perhaps work for you, but there was no guarantees. And there was the only thing that was more or less certain was that you were looking at a significantly shortened life. So this is the moment when I was told this news. I'd had some back pain, but I thought I'd just pulled something. You know, it wasn't something I was expecting, was what I was told. 2 weeks later, Karen Verrill rang me and asked if she could pop in and see me around tea time. She was a nurse specialist that was assigned to me, I mean obviously other women as well, but she was your first port of call for any problems or concerns that you had, because it was much harder to get hold of a consultant or make another appointment to go into hospital. So she lived on the same street as me, Her request to pop in and see me didn't really strike me as peculiar. She'd often popped in to help me out with some concern I had, just to save me trailing into the hospital. On this occasion, I hadn't sought her, but I looked forward to seeing her anyway and carried on as normal. She arrived. I was in the kitchen with all the children, who were playing and watching TV and waiting for food. Mark was still at work. We sat down at the table. My stomach started to churn a little. There was something in the atmosphere that just told me this was not a coffee date with my friend. Rebecca, the results of your biopsy came in today. You have secondary breast cancer in your spine. Am I going to live long enough to see all my children grow up? No, she said. Right. So how long do you think I have? Well, that's a really hard question to answer, Rebecca. Currently, I'd say the average is 5 to 6 years. It depends how you respond to the treatments. I'm sure that everybody who can imagine that scenario, children there, and, you know, I'd just sort of got over the primary one, really. And there you are, faced with this news. And there was a lot more detail that went into that. But you can read that in the book. That's a good reason to buy it, isn't it? The thing with secondary breast cancer, as the consultant explained to me at the time, it's a bit of a loose cannon. So it can kind of turn up anywhere in your body at any time, and depending how you respond to the drugs will depend on your success. So it's a bit of a minefield, really. And pretty quickly it spread into multiple areas in my bones. But the next big one was my lungs. At the time, I did an awful lot of running. I'd found it actually shortly after being after I had Archie, and then, wrestling to get my life back into some sort of order. And I discovered running, and I discovered I was quite good at it. So it was a way of, you know, sort of getting sort of pent up stress and energy out, and also feeling good about what I could achieve still. I was doing the park runs. Do you have park runs over? Yeah. So I did those every week, and I trained very, very hard for them. And I did really well. So I was running at that time. And this won't mean anything to anybody, but I thought I'd just tell you anyway, because one day this was me. In the past, it was me. That a 5K race I could do in about 20 minutes, 20:05. So I was pretty good. But just before I got diagnosed with it in my lungs, I began to notice that I was slowing down. And when I was running, I couldn't often breathe. I couldn't often get my breath properly. And I think in the back of my mind, I suspected that this cancer was potentially in my lungs, and that's what the problem was. However, before that finally got confirmed, I went for some more park runs, and sometimes I found it too hard to do it, but on this particular occasion, I was doing it, and I feel like I got a bit of a blessing. So, my angel Gabriel. The runner did not race past me. It was a guy. He pulled up beside me and slipped into pace with me rather than view me as competition. I sensed that it was an intentional move on his part, and I managed to turn my puce face towards him to ascertain what his tactic might be, and couldn't avoid noticing that he was gorgeous. He was clearly in good shape, and for a moment my legs lost the lead-like feeling and I developed like little wings on them, which I momentarily flew on. I tried to wipe the crusty dried saliva from the corner of my mouth and smeared the back of my hand under my nostrils to brush off the embarrassing old woman nose drip that had been swinging there for 2 or 3 minutes. I thought, well, hey, I really must stop putting myself down. Clearly, even in this state, I have mummy magnetism. Then this demigod spoke. I saw you really struggling, and I'm going to run you home. Well, I'd take anything, so, you know, whatever he wanted to say. I wasn't sure how to respond to this, and at the time, with my body about to combust and my stomach doing backflips, I just grunted something and tried to half lift my hand in thankful acknowledgement of his camaraderie. And run me home he did, like a pro. He took on my pace, but ran just a stride in front so that I could keep with him. A few encouraging words whenever I exhumed an involuntary, pained snorkeling sound, and we crossed the line. I managed to stay upright, and my barcode scanned with my demigod ahead of me. After I'd managed to stop retching, bent double with a perfect view of demigod's muscular legs, he turned and said, "I'm Gabriel, but I prefer Gabe." This is true, right? This is honestly true. "I'm Gabriel, but I prefer Gabe." I thought, what? Gabriel? Have I just had a really supernatural experience? I knew people who claimed to have seen angels. One of my good friends at church sees one of them regularly, and he even has a name, Hector. Honestly, this is true. Could it be that an angel stepped to help me, called Gabriel, the top angel? Angel Gabriel. I gawped at him. I was like, oh. He spoke. "You sounded like you might collapse. I hope you don't mind me helping." I looked at him, and I'm sure I could see a supernatural glow. He must have strapped his wings pretty tightly into his fitted Nike running t-shirt, because I could see no evidence of stray feathers. I tried to mumble about that I didn't mind at all. The angel concept was beginning to crumble, though, when a 5'8", 20-something, long-legged, tanned, swinging, ponytailed, summer-kissed blonde hair came running towards him and kissed him full on the lips. So moving on, you know, quite a number of years now to 2016, and with it in many parts of my body, but they were all under control, and, you know, slowly but surely, I never quite managed to return to what I was like before anything happened, but I would always fight through and get to a stage where, you know, I could sort of do what I needed to do. But in 2016, I had some serious headaches, and it was diagnosed as being in my brain. They thought initially that it might just be in a tiny location and I could have some stereotactic radiotherapy, which is like a very focused radiotherapy that would just go into that bit. But on a further scan, they discovered that it was in multiple areas, and therefore I needed to have my whole brain fried. Blam, the whole thing. A few days later, I arrived at my radiotherapy consultation, expecting to be seen by a radiologist who would simply describe in more detail how long my treatment was going to last and give me the sheet with the dates and the times. Instead, I was ushered into Mr. Verrill's consultation room, my right-hand man and stalwart companion in the goal of keeping me alive, and beckoned to sit down. I'm a straight-talking girl and he's a straight-talking man, but I barely perched my bottom on the edge of the seat before he started. I have your scan results. The deeper, more detailed scan has revealed multiple sites of disease in many places in your brain. It's pointless carrying on with the idea of a more focused treatment. We need to just give you a full brain radiotherapy. What was he talking about? I had tumours in my brain, like everywhere. How had that happened? How had I moved from what seemed like a manageable little lump in my left breast to a few years later, brain tumours? It was surreal, and it actually did make me laugh a bit. Obviously not because it was funny, but because it was so insane and so unreal and unimaginable. It's just one of those places that you do not want to hear the word cancer mentioned. I immediately thought, this is it. My final card is about to be played. I really believed for a few moments that this had to be it. Clearly, that's not to be. Just onto the final bit now. I'm going to share with you. The book that I've brought with me today that I really hope you're all going to buy. Have I said that already? I've got a book for sale that I'd like you to buy. Buy two, three. Okay. I wrote it in the very beginning. I didn't even know that I would have it published. I wrote it for the children. I wanted them to understand when they look back on the first however many years of their lives, what was going on around that time. Hopefully so that this would enable them to understand some of the deficiencies and the difficulties. So I'm just going to finish off reading this section to you, and then you can go and buy like a book. The love of a mother. The love of a mother is a one-off love. Nobody else can claim it. Nobody else can replace it. Nobody else will ever be who I am and love them like I do. No other woman will ever feel as strongly and passionately, would give their own life for them, die for them if necessary, have sleepless nights over them, cry tears of pride and joy over them. Only me. And at the moment, it looks like they'll be robbed of that immense love long before they should be. This book is an effort towards leaving a bit of me with them. I'm so grateful I was inspired to do it and that I have had the tenacity to achieve it. I thank God that he has helped me when I felt like giving it up. My lovely children may not actually read it, but that's okay, because I just pray that by owning it, it will fill them with comfort. A treasure chest of truthful revelation on who I was, my strengths and my weaknesses, my highs and my lows. And of course, it's just a flavour, a glimpse. I know I haven't been everything to them that I wish I could have been, but I want them to know this, that I have tried my best. I've tried the best that I could. I really have. And above all else, even at the times when it will have looked like I didn't, I want them to know how much I love them. I love them all differently, but all equally, with a love that was overwhelming and mighty in its power. I could attempt to summarise what I've learned and leave this on an inspirational high, like a nice gift wrapped carefully with ribbons and bows. But I can't seem to think of anything. I'm still sick, very sick, and due another round of whole brain radiotherapy. I went on a very tolerable chemo, which managed everything very nicely for about 2 years, but my brain started being naughty again. And I'm now in December 2018, waiting to begin more radiotherapy on the 6 tumours that have grown larger. I'm still likely to depart this world, medically speaking, much sooner than I'd like. I'm still a bit ditzy and often get things wrong and make mistakes. I'm still just me. But somehow, do you know what I've realised? That cancer has been good for me. Did you take that in? Cancer has been good for me. The version of me that I am now, after nearly 10 years since the start, is, well, I think, so much nicer than the one I knew before this all started. And I'm so grateful that it's all happened. So enormously grateful, because out of the ashes has grown a sort of a beauty. I'm not saying I'm really beautiful. I'm just saying that my soul has matured and changed through all these battles. And I haven't been destroyed or burnt to the ground. And out of this destruction has come such joy in my life. I wrote a poetry book, and this is just, I'm just going to finish with this little extract from one of the poems. Life can hand you lemons, it's true, but what you do with those lemons is all down to you. Look for the stars in the darkest night. Clouds may be hiding them, but they're still shining bright. Look around the problem, the solution is there. Choose life, love, and laughter. Never lonely despair. Oh, thank you. Thank you. That looks like people who are ready to get their wallets out. Thank you so much for coming. I just want to say some quick thank yous. I want to thank my sister, Ruth, and the team for putting the soup on and the cakes, because that was delicious. And she's really, really good at supporting me in that way. The books are on sale over there. Some of them have got colour illustrations in, and some have got black and white. And they were done by an amazing friend of mine in Whitley Bay, Richard Brown. So I hope you appreciate the work that's gone into that. And I just thank you all. Thanks for coming. Thanks for listening. It's been a pleasure.
There might be a bit more old wine and cake.
Oh, well, I'm first. Yes, I do. Why?
I'm going to buy two of your books.
Oh, they're just over there, and I'm going to sit here. I'll